Chinese ride-hailing giant Didi bids farewell to the New York Stock Exchange. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. An announcement early this morning from Didi has sent shares soaring more than 9% ahead of the opening bell on Wall Street. Under pressure from the Chinese government, the company said it will delist from the New York Stock Exchange and move its shares to Hong Kong. The move also comes after U.S. regulators said they can themselves delist foreign companies who fail to provide information to auditors. The BBC's Marika Oi has more on that decision from Singapore.
Chinese tech companies have been under scrutiny at home and abroad, and the country's ride-hailing giant, Didi, has been at odds with Chinese regulators for months. Few days after the firm went public on Wall Street in late June, Beijing removed Didi from app stores and accused it of violating data security rules. Didi said it's preparing to list in Hong Kong, and shareholders of its US-listed stocks will be able to convert their holdings to those on another stock exchange. The company's also preparing to relaunch its apps in China by the end of the year.
That's the BBC's Marika Oi reporting there. Well, after 5 years and $6 billion, a new high-speed rail line is open today in the Southeast Asian nation, Laos. That's the sound of a train attendant greeting passengers on one of the first test journeys. The project spans 250 miles from southwest China to the Laotian capital, and it's designed to help modernize one of Asia's poorest countries. But it's been financed by the Chinese government's Belt and Road Initiative, which has raised concerns about whether the debt load will be too much for Laos to bear. The BBC's Jonathan Head explains the cost and the benefits of the project.
Compared to some of China's other railway projects, it's not actually that big. It's not a very high-speed railway. The trains will only be travelling at about 160 kilometres an hour. China has some of the most advanced high-speed railway technology in the world, and it's built state-of-the-art high-speed links in places like Turkey, for example, hoping to compete with Japan's famous Shinkansen bullet train technology. But for Laos, it's a very big deal indeed. This is a very poor, landlocked country. GDP is only at about $2,500 per capita, much poorer than its neighbours, much, much poorer than China, and very cut off too, being landlocked. It has no coast, it's mountainous, it has very poor road systems. So to have this reasonably modern railway system linking it to southwestern China, Laos is hoping this starts to bring proper modern communications links with its neighbours and will help boost trade and tourism from China. And of course, China has ambitions that this is going to be the first stage in a much wider railway network that's going to go through the rest of mainland Southeast Asia.
And these Belt and Road projects have been criticized, described by many as debt trap diplomacy. This line has put Laos about $1 billion in debt, which it now owes China. Can it repay that debt?
I think it probably can, but obviously there are a lot of questions, and this is a country which is suffering, like all the countries in the region, from the impact of COVID on tourism, which is quite an important source of income for Laos, particularly Chinese tourists. Of course, Chinese tourists are not allowed to travel right now at all, so they're certainly not going to be coming on this railway line. The first runs are carrying freight, not passengers. So I think there are serious questions about that. And you just have to look at the rest of Southeast Asia to see how hesitant they are to embrace the export of China's railway technology. Most of them, a lot more prosperous than Laos, would like the prestige of modern high-speed railways. They see that as a mark of how far they've developed. But when they look at the cost of it and the possible benefits, they're starting to have doubts. Thailand's been negotiating to build its link in this railway, which should take the railway from the Lao capital, Vientiane, down to Bangkok and eventually link southwestern China to the Gulf of Thailand, the South China Sea. Thailand's been negotiating that for the last 7 years, and they've constantly renegotiated. They've just started building a part of the railway, but they're uneasy because the commercial terms for bringing in the Chinese technology and funding it, they've not been able to agree on. Malaysia, likewise, was supposed to build a railway with Chinese technology and Chinese loans. They suspended that last year because it was so expensive at $20 billion. They renegotiated it at a lower cost and are proceeding quite slowly. So I think Laos, very much under the thumb of Chinese influence, was willing to go along with this project. Arguably, with its very low income levels, it's in the weakest position to benefit directly. The only way I think the railway will help is if it does network Laos in to a much wider railway network and somehow help to connect it trade-wise and sort of people-wise, but that railway network is not going to be built anytime soon.
The BBC's Jonathan Head for us. Thanks for breaking all this down for us.
Good to talk to you.
It's been a volatile week, so a quick check of financial markets now. Global benchmarks are moving slightly higher. U.S. stock futures are down in the 0.2% to 0.4% range. We'll get the latest monthly employment figures in a few hours. Expectations are for the U.S. to have added 550,000 new jobs in November. Meanwhile, the Turkish lira has shed more than 12% this week. Data today showed an annual inflation climbed to more than 21% last month, its highest level in 3 years. Well, good news for business around the globe. The World Trade Organization has agreed to slash red tape, cutting trade costs by an estimated $150 billion a year. It's being called a landmark deal that the WTO says will deliver trade rules fit for the 21st century. The BBC's Chris Morris explains what exactly that means.
It basically tries to make it easier to sell services around the world. There's this complex web of regulations which mean that selling services is twice as expensive, really, the cost of trade in services as compared to the trade in goods. So it's things like making it easier to obtain licenses, making it easier to get your professional qualifications recognised, making sure technical standards are kind of harmonised. All sounds great in theory. Of course, all these countries have actually got to implement all of this. And I think that's the big if in this. But it's really good that it's happened because it's been so difficult for the World Trade Organization to create any agreement on services. They haven't done one for a quarter of a century. So I think that's the kind of symbolic importance of this. A group of countries have got together and achieved something. According to the OECD, it could save $150 billion a year in terms of the cost of trade around the world. But I think we have to wait and see whether that theory actually turns into practice.
So sort of a landmark in that we've agreed something. But are there certain countries that will benefit more than others from this agreement?
Yeah, I mean, it's no surprise that the countries that have welcomed it most, that have been most enthusiastic, are the big service exporters. So the US, the UK all think this is fantastic because those countries have already got pretty sort of more liberal rules on how you can sell services. The key thing for them is to get their exporters and to make it easier for them in other markets. So places like Russia, Brazil, China, who all signed up to this. But again, are they actually going to implement it? Are you going to go to an obscure office somewhere in eastern Siberia and find that, yes, just one form does get your professional qualification recognised? That's going to be the key thing. But yeah, the big service exporters have said, look, this proves that the WTO can do business, especially when instead of operating by consensus, which has been the big difficulty, everyone has to agree, more than 160 countries. This is kind of a coalition of the willing. So 67 countries have signed up to this so far, representing more than 90% of services trade. So a big chunk of that trade. And that may be the way in the future, a model for doing business on other issues. Whoever wants to move forward can.
The BBC's Chris Morris. Thanks so much for breaking this down.
Thank you very much.
Now, a question for you. Is there a business or economic trend story you want to know more about? Write us at marketplace@bbc.co.uk, or you can always tweet me. I'm at Victoria Craig. In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.